Welcome to Carry the Fire, a podcast where we explore the big questions of life through the lens of the good, the true, and the beautiful. I'm your host, Dustin Kensrue, and my hope is that through these conversations with people of diverse and divergent backgrounds and beliefs, we can glimpse the world anew through each other's unique perspectives.
I always say that plot is sort of irrelevant unless you assume that characters create plot with whatever they do. Anything a character does creates plot, but too many storytellers, I think, approach plot like it's a thing you kind of like start with and then sort of graft characters onto the plot. But it really, to me, needs to be the other way around, and that creates an organic, hopefully, ideally, growth for how the narrative goes. And then I let them take the lead on it and do what they're going to do in response to it. If what they do changes my perception of what the story was going to do, that's great. That's actually ideal because it means it surprised me. And then if it surprises me, it ideally surprises readers.
Hey, everybody. Today on the pod, we're joined by Chuck Windig. Chuck is an author and storyteller in a variety of mediums. He is most well known through his novels, the most recent of which is titled Wanderers, and which I read recently and really enjoyed. In our conversation, we talk about the way that fiction interacts with the good, the true, and the beautiful, including the relationship of canon to both fiction and religion, the way that fiction can help us see things that reality has obscured, and the way that the best fiction both gives you an escape while simultaneously bringing you right back to the real issues from a novel perspective, pun intended. Let's dive in. Thanks for doing this.
Hey, thanks, man.
I like starting with the question of what would cause you to feel a deep sense of wonder when you were a kid? Because I feel like it gets at some of this stuff in a different way.
What would cause me to feel a deep sense of wonder when I was a kid? And it's something that I think we're missing a little now, and I understand why we're missing it, but adventures? Does that make any sense? I would just leave my house and disappear until someone, we had a bell, an old rusty bell on our front porch that someone would ring when it was time for dinner. But I mean, starting in the middle of the day or even in the morning, I would just get the hell out of the house and be gone.
Yeah. Where did you live? Where'd you grow up?
Philly suburbs. So it's pretty wild. Trees and I grew up on a farm. So we had 16 acres But even then, it wasn't just the farm. I would get on a bike and ride 10 miles, and no one would know where I was. There was no cell phones. No one would have any idea where I was, but it was fine.
Yeah, that's just hard because we, went through this weird period where we got conditioned to think that everyone was getting kidnapped all the time. And if you look at the numbers, it's safer than it was in a lot of ways.
I remember we were warned about not just molesters in vans, but Satanists. It's not a thing, as it turns out. They weren't coming for us at all. But everyone was look, someone spray painted a pentagram on a wall. The Satanists are here. And you're that was just some kids doing that.
Oh man, yeah, that was a big thing. The Satanists and the Russians.
Russians.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, that's coming back in a weird way, but
so we just need Satan to come back, and then we're in.
Yeah, I feel like at least now there's some there's nuance. It's Putin is bad, I don't know how old you are. I'm almost 40, but when I grew up,
I'm just past my 40s.
It was the Russians are the bad guy. They are evil. Yeah. All of them. Yes. I don't know that. Yeah. At least all as a them, kid, everyone, that care. Was that was the understanding.
Drowning kids in borscht and whatever they were doing. Yeah, yeah, horrible.
Okay. So yeah, adventure. You would just get out
just
and
be
go.
Adventurous.
Yeah.
Just leave.
Okay.
And it was scary too. Sometimes you'd be, because you didn't know where you were, or you'd find some weirdo out there, or you'd just be it was this moment of fear and wonder, and because you kind of felt a little bit on your own. Which again, terrifying, uh-huh. But in a good way sometimes.
Yeah, and that's empowering, and part of growing up is those little moments of independence,
that's right,
for
testing
you,
your
large
borders.
Moments.
Seeing a bigger world, sure.
Yeah, but it's hard. I wonder. I don't know. I feel like we have a different headspace to work through than our parents did for like letting our own kids do that stuff.
Yeah, like our parents came out of that like generation where you had a ton of kids, knowing that like, well, at least two of these aren't going to make it. So, and then you know they need to work, you know, the fields or whatever it was. Like, you know, I need someone to work the plow and feed the horses. So we're in a different, you know, kids are a little more precious now. They're almost like, you know, pet, like a dog. When I was a kid, some people just had dogs for the purposes of chaining them up outside and barking at strangers. Horrible. I mean, we can't even imagine that now, that you'd be like, yeah, I just have a dog and I put him on a chain in the driveway. And that's what the dog is to me. But now, obviously, we don't do that. Dogs are, you know, pets in general are sort of precious parts of the family. And back then, they were like tools. They were like, "What is my, you know, is my alarm system? Is a golden retriever?"
Yeah, go. Totally. Yeah, it's very interesting thinking about how, actually, how quickly too our ideas about certain things shift.
Yeah.
But yeah, I live like near this like cool creek trail. It's actually, I used to play on it when I was a kid, and now there's a bunch more houses around it. But I let my kids like go out, they have a cell phone with them, which makes me feel a little better, but like they yeah, can go, I mean, out,
yeah,
there
the
and
cell
go,
phone,
you know?
I think,
but it's, yeah, I think it's good for them, feeling that weird sense of like, you know, they'll eat shit on their bike and they're by themselves, yeah, and they got it. Or my daughter saw a coyote the other day. She's like,
that's awesome.
She's like, "Dad, was either a wolf or a coyote." I said, "I think it was a coyote, but okay."
Yeah, smart money says coyote, but that's cool.
Yeah. All right. So you are the first novelist I've had on the show. I've had, you know, people who are authors in various ways, but usually it's kind of writing around, you know, their work or maybe a more of a memoir type thing. But yeah, you're the first like novelist fiction writer.
Oh, cool.
I want to talk a little bit about like the way that novels have impacted you and your, and like thinking about your own novels in relation to the good, the true, and the beautiful. So I want to talk about truth first. And if any of these don't resonate, I'll just edit it out. So don't worry about it.
No, we'll figure it out. I'll get the answers.
Yeah. So truth, I'll look at kind of in two ways. Like one, like facts. Like I feel like sometimes fiction books have like, you know, you do research, like there's interesting things there. And then also like maybe truth has like a deeper understanding of reality learned through the reading, of a fiction book. But yeah, so to start with like the facts kind of thing, like, is there a book that you remember like learning, like kind of being blown away by like certain facts, certain like stuff you never knew about and you're like, what?
Specifically about, like fiction?
Book, like a novel? Yeah, fiction book. Like,
yeah. There's a novel that really sort of affected me as a kid, an epic horror novel called Swan Song. It was in the same vein as The Stand, but it wasn't a pandemic book. It was a nuclear apocalypse type book. And still supernatural. Like it was like the end of the world via nuclear war, but then this like sort of devil-like figure rises up and begins to, you know, cause havoc as devil-like figures are wont to do. And I thought, I just didn't know. You know, I mean, we were in the middle of nuclear panic back then, going back to that whole, like, you know, Satanists and molesters. But, you know, nukes were obviously a core component to that. And reading the book was fascinating because it taught me a lot. Like, I didn't know, when I was a kid, I didn't know that we had all these secret launch tubes in, like, buried under cornfields in the Midwest. Mm-hmm. And, like, that turned out to be true. Like, yeah, in fact, now they're selling those things for, you know, rich people as their, like, apocalypse bunkers, which is ironic and hilarious and disturbing in equal measure. So just sort of learning about all of the things that happen to people after exposure to radiation and walking ghost phase and all that stuff was sort of grotesque to learn as like a preteen or teenager. But it was cool. I mean, it's like, you know, in that sort of way that helped you contextualize all the strange, terrible things in the world. So that's like sort of facts. But then truth is probably The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy. Mm. Just because it's such, I mean, it's obviously a completely made up fake satire type of book, you know, about, you know, galactic shenanigans, but there's so much truth to the absurdity of life and existence and bureaucracy And, you know, just the sort of little rituals we have from whether it's a computer program or making tea. I just thought there were a lot of weird little truths in those books that were useful. And as the books went on, they became a little more overtly philosophical. Not always to their success, but always to make, I mean, it was interesting.
Yeah. And
he sort of took these, you know, simple things and made them bigger.
Yeah. And it ends up, I think, engaging people in questions that, you know, they might not have found their way to any other way.
Right. Exactly.
There's an Emerson quote. It says, fiction reveals truth that reality obscures.
Yeah.
Which I like, fair. Because I think reality in the sense of, you know, the modern world and all of the things we're caught up with, like a lot of that is built to obscure a deeper truth because it's trying to, you know, get money from you or whatever it is. Like,
right.
You know, so instead of wondering what really makes me happy, you are being sold something that is supposed to make you happy, right?
Precisely. Yeah. It's all a distraction to some degree. Yeah.
So I recently read Wanderers, which I loved.
Thank you.
And I feel like you probably did a bunch of research in that book. Like,
yeah, but I mean, part of it was, I'm both a really lazy and a really greedy writer in that, a lot of what goes into that book was stuff I was already interested in. So I had already done research, not for purposes of using it in a book, but just because it was fascinating and strange to me. Epidemiology to artificial intelligence to, you know, obviously politics to getting that all together. And then Wanderers sort of coalesced and contextualized a lot of my weird anxieties and interests at the same time. And instead of just sort of picking one and running with it, I was like, well, what if I put all of the snakes in the can? That'll be a good way to write this book. So I literally like just jammed the book full of all of the things that I was interested in, both as, again, an act of supreme laziness and greed.
It's kind of rad, though, because it... I'll try not to do spoilers. I don't know. We might not be able to...
It's hard.
If you... you should all go read Wanderers if you haven't before you listen to this. I feel like it doesn't end up coming across as... like weirdly packed full. It gives like a, I don't know, it gives like a broader reality to the story because all these things are interacting. It's not just like hyper focused on one thing and it's out of context of everything else. It's like these things all affect each other, and you know, like, which is the way that especially like any kind of pandemic works, is it is affecting one thing and then it affects everything else because of that.
Yeah, I really wanted to create that sense of that all these gears were working together and giving it enough time and energy around the characters to sort of sell all of the weirder stuff. Like, it's really about characters, and if they're not finding a connection to all those things and being the movers of everything that's happening, I always say that plot is sort of irrelevant unless you assume that characters create plot with whatever they do. Anything a character does creates plot, but too many storytellers, I think, approach plot like it's a thing you kind of like start with and then sort of graft characters onto the plot. But it really, to me, needs to be the other way around. And that creates an organic, hopefully, ideally, growth for how the narrative goes.
Yeah. How do you, so you try to start with maybe a rough idea and then find your characters to figure out where the story needs to go.
Yeah. And then I let them take the lead on it and do what they're going to do in response to it. And, if what they do changes my perception of what the story was going to do, that's great. That's actually ideal because it means it surprised me. And then if it surprises me, it you know, ideally surprises readers. And that's kind of one of the goals anyway, is simply surprising people.
Do you have the general thing laid out though, after you've kind of like played with this in your head before you write it all?
I usually do.
Okay.
Wanderers, I didn't.
Really?
Wanderers was just like I had pieces and I knew where it was going to end up, though not exactly how. Like physically in the book, I knew the location of where I wanted it to go. But beyond that, no, it was really, I was sort of building it. It was a book that showed me I didn't know how to read book or write books because it was entirely different. And everything I thought that I knew about how I wrote books, not just about how writers write, but how I write, tended to be wrong. So I whiffed my deadline, and I wrote a huge book that I didn't know I was going to write as big a book as I did. I wasn't steady. Like sometimes, you know, usually when I write a book, I write about 2,000 words a day and kind of hit that pace. Mm-hmm. But this was like some days I'd write 500 words, some days I'd write 5,000.
Hmm.
It was way more erratic. But ultimately, it came out feeling more organic as a result of that. I don't know if I'll ever be able to do that again. So we'll
do. I mean,
we'll see.
Do you feel like that is partially because it was being powered by all of these random things together? Like, what do you attribute the difference to?
Yeah, I mean, it might be that, you know, if there's an analog to cooking, sometimes if you get the right ingredients together, it's mostly just about adjusting levels and discovering the flavors. But maybe it's because I've been doing it for a long time, you know, and you just some things you figure out some things sort of internally about how you tell stories, but you don't know them intellectually.
Yeah,
I have no idea. Or maybe it was just the right time for that book.
Yeah, that's kind of what I wonder. It's so intimately like connected to what is actually happening in the world right now in a variety of weird ways, but like
in a variety of very weird ways.
Yeah, yeah. So I mean, you have AI and they're detecting a pandemic. You have a pandemic going on. What I mean, there's from bats. Yeah, it's like it's
from bats.
But then all the political stuff and like
white supremacy rising. Yeah, it's a whole thing.
Yeah, and I feel like I don't know. I think it's a helpful way to hopefully for some people to see some of that stuff, especially on the way you handle like some of the white supremacy stuff. Through a sympathetic character kind of coming into contact with that stuff and like showing, I don't know, some of like the pull of a ideology or something. While then starting to show the dark side of it in a way that's not just like, hey, this is bad. It's giving a more visceral sense of that. And I think that's that thing. Like it's, you can't do that in a, at least not in the same way. It doesn't impact you the same way in an essay or something. You're not living it.
Have some legs to it.
I want to talk a little bit in the truth thing on like canon issues. I know you tweeted that it was an article from IO9 or something a while back talking about people's obsession with canon kind of ruining stuff. There's a quote from it that I thought it was great. It says, the hunger for facts above all else leads to things like filler episode becoming a derogatory term for stories that don't advance the larger ongoing plot or don't include some shocking new revelation that someone can add to a list. This need robs discussions about the stories of nuance and interpretation, because who cares what you think happened when there's an answer from the Word of God to the question that you might've had. So you tweeted, this is true and right. I wonder if you had anything like you thoughts that sparked in you, or have you experienced any of that like over intense canon thirst like with your own work?
Yeah, absolutely. Writing Star Wars, people are very obsessed with canon, and I even wrote one Marvel story that was a Vader connection to Rogue One, and it never overtly says what it says. It just makes some suggestions about what Darth Vader's involvement in the Death Star plans and the corruption of those plans. And people were like, well, this isn't, how could this be canon? Because it doesn't perfectly agree with everything that came before, as if everything could perfectly agree with everything that came before. And they view, curiously, they view things like Star Wars or any sort of fandom with whatever their particular, you know, piece of media is that they love so much. They view it almost more unflinchingly than we view history, because we recognize that history and to a degree also science are a series of teleporting bullseyes. Like we understand that history is constantly a thing that's being kind of excavated and relearned and changed, sometimes in good ways and changed in bad ways. History is a sort of a record of what happened, and our advancement of that and how we experience history changes over time, depending on who's telling that story, depending on what book you're reading, depending on what new pieces of information have been learned. But they can't view Star Wars the same way, or they can't view Star Trek or Transformers or whatever it is. There are some people who are really locked into a sort of a quote-unquote fact-based Wikipedia style storytelling narrative universe. Like, well, these are the facts and everything works together and everything plugs together. So they can't disagree and you can't do interesting stories because everything's sort of locked tight in a paradigm of quote unquote fact, even though it's obviously all made up. So you just like, you know, you're like, want to be like, well, I want to tell an interesting story here. And if that fudges canon a little bit, the value is the interesting story, not canon. And these people often point to someone like Tolkien for being like sort of the master of his own canon universe. But even Tolkien's work didn't agree with itself constantly. It was changing things and sometimes playfully and sometimes ways that I don't even know that he recognized he was changing things. Because that's important and vital that we do that and we evolve or see stories as an evolving thing, just as history and science are.
Yeah, it made me, as I was reading that and thinking about kind of my own journey from, like, I grew up evangelical, and there's this huge obsession with, like, it's all hung together on this idea of inerrancy, that the Bible is like this perfect thing and doesn't contradict itself. And it is a very similar kind of feeling that I was seeing in, like, there's almost the people who are obsessed with canon in fiction are almost doing so in like this strange kind of religious sense where it's like you're messing with my scripture, right? Like, but it misses this understanding that even with something like the Bible or something, it's been written over time by a bunch of different people, and those people have always been engaged in changing the story to a degree. They're taking what came before and they're writing what they feel like is the thing they need to write then. And it's a conversation over time, which is amazing. If you see it, you're like, oh wow, look what we can learn from like the way that these different humans and communities have engaged this idea of God. And
I mean, the Gospels alone, four stories separate and divergent in the Bible. And then there's how many that didn't make it into the core canon. And, you know, Revelation, as a, you could view it as something that's quote unquote revelatory to the apocalypse, or you could view it as a subversive letter from someone trapped on an island who had very strong opinions about his current time and not, you know, coding to our time. So there's so many, to miss all of that is to miss all of it. I mean, it sounds strange, but you're missing the point.
Yeah.
If you're like really just like, these are truths, these are facts, not even truths, but facts, details that must be true for everything to work. And reality just doesn't work like that.
Well, and then it causes a bunch of cognitive dissonance when part of you knows that that's not all staying together. It's not all saying the same thing. Like, you can see that, but you have to figure out a way to believe that it does. And it, I did not enjoy that. But
yeah, it's a tough one.
Yeah, so I spent a long time trying to put the pieces together and realized, oh, this is maybe the wrong way to look at this whole thing. I also thought it was interesting, though, that, like, there is something of the spirit of, like, going beyond the creator or something, where, like, Lucas himself, who's basically God to Star Wars, like, gets pushback, right? When he does stuff in the prequels or something that you're like, no, like, this wouldn't be the thing. And I feel like there's something in that spirit, not that you, it's like, look, he's making the thing, he's going to make the thing, and you can disagree with it, but, like, I don't know. There's something good in that impulse, I think, to be like, man, I think even though you created this thing, like, you're missing something. I don't know. That's maybe like a textual criticism.
And I think that's good. Yeah. Well, and it's interesting to watch the fandom's sort of complex relationship with him, because initially it started out when obviously he's a genius for creating Star Wars, and then the prequels, and he's like, well, he's a jerk for creating Star Wars. And then he changed the original films, and then some people love those and some people hate them, and you shouldn't mess with perfection, but even though it's his thing to mess with. And then, so they hated him for a long time. And then he sort of killed Star Wars for a while in the sense that it was just, he didn't want to make any more movies. And so they were mad at him for that. But then he sold them to Disney and Disney did their own thing. But now he's, to some people, George is sort of a saint again. Like, he's been canonized to his own sainthood. And you can't now, how dare you do differently, even though a lot of the stuff they're mad about the new movies is stuff that he planted seeds in anyway and was like, well, he supports it. And it's just such a strange, people's relationships to that sort of author-auteur effect is kind of fascinating, sometimes in a great way and sometimes in a really weird way.
Yeah, I feel like that, I mean, it's a fascinating case study because it's such a huge phenomenon and it's spanned over like multiple people's lifetimes now. And so you have different generations interacting about it. And yeah, it's all sorts of weird. I've come to appreciate some stuff about the prequels that I didn't earlier. Like, I think the story arc of the way that democracy is subverted and all that is actually really interesting. And
right on. It was very sharp how he predicted some of that stuff. Like, the politics are surprisingly good.
Yeah.
It's just kind of the rest of it that's a little goofy.
Yeah. I think had he not directed it, it might have gone a lot better. Mm-hmm. But
yeah.
Apparently, he tried to get other people to direct it, and everyone was like, no, you do it, buddy.
It's all you. You take this one.
Oh, that's so sad. So, fiction, what is it? What is it good for? There's a quote which is rehashed from other things, but David Foster Wallace applies it to fiction specifically. He said, good fiction's job is to comfort the disturbed and disturb the comfortable. What do you think about that?
I don't hate it. I mean, there's an aspect of fiction that can be escapist, and there's an aspect of fiction which is the opposite, which brings you closer to the type of thing you're trying to escape. Mm-hmm. And then there's a really almost masterful form, and it's something that genre is very good at when in the right hands, is it something that feels escapist, but it's really talking about the exact thing you're trying to escape from. So it's somehow giving you contrarily both of those things at the same time. And that's really, I think, the maximum power of fiction is to both give you entertainment, but then also to make you think and feel things at the same time.
Yeah, I like that. Do you have a book that you remember that was like a large comfort to you in a certain time?
Comfort to me.
I mean, that could be broad. I mean, that could be, it just gave you an escape from something horrible. Or
I read, before I was really reading books, I was reading comic strips, not comic books, but like I was reading Bloom County and Calvin and Hobbes and Farside. Mm-hmm. And those were my earliest escape because they were sort of really absurd and deranged in a wonderful way. But I also feel, especially with something like Calvin and Hobbes and Bloom County, I mean, and Farside, really all of them, there were some sort of deep, squirrely truths buried in there. They were not, you know, Calvin and Hobbes especially sometimes really stare down the barrel of like, sure, he's a kid imagining all kinds of insane stuff, but there's some rich loam and soil kind of going on in those strips. So definitely those were things that were comforting and escapist to me, but that even looking back now, you're like, oh, there was a lot going on.
Yeah, that's cool.
in three panels than you could have imagined.
Yeah, I used to, my dad gave me, he had his Farsides and Calvin and Hobbes, and it was, I had a couple of books like stored away. I tried to get my kids into it. One of them liked it, but, don't know.
There my kid hasn't gone there yet.
I really liked them, but I think I really liked them especially cause like my dad gave them to me and it was like a shared thing. All right. What about a book that has afflicted you in that way? That's like kind of brought something to bear on you that you wouldn't have saw otherwise, maybe.
Like in an upsetting way,
like
disturb the comfortable.
Like where you're like, oh man, I hadn't thought about that, and I'd probably need to.
Yeah, some of the early works of like Poppy Bright were pretty fantastic. There's a novel that she wrote, though now he's Billy Martin. A novel called Exquisite Corpse, which is just a grisly, disturbing serial, like a gay serial killer book, and the goriest, sloppiest viscera, but beautiful in its prose. I mean, really astonishingly beautiful in how it was written. And there was something to that that was so upsetting, but also to find that there were these characters finding love in this sort of visceral, in the most literal sense, visceral place. Was interesting. just an unsettling, uncomfortable book. Almost that sense of like watching or reading Requiem for a Dream. There's just that like, okay. You start to realize like not everybody reads fiction to feel good about things, do you? And then you're like, oh, okay. So that's good to know. And that's certainly, I've been there and done that. And, you know, certain times of my life, you really cleave toward those types of books as opposed to steer away from them.
Yeah. As in a way of, I don't know, maybe like commiseration, like someone else is thinking in this dark place right now.
Yeah. And also, and if you're in a more comfortable place, it's easier to read that type of thing. Mm. Whereas if you're in a less comfortable place, whether globally or emotionally, sometimes you want a little more, want home cooking and not something strange.
Yeah, that makes sense. There's a NPR review of Wanderers that said it's full of social commentary that digs into everything from global warming to racial tension while never preaching or bogging down the action-packed story. I think that's true. And I wondered, like, what does it look like for you to try to have commentary in there without, preaching in the pejorative sense?
It's hard. But you never, to me, preaching is about talking down to and talking over people, mm-hmm. trying to be like, I'm just trying to broadcast a thought into your head via the book. And I don't want to do that. I said one of the things a book should make you do is make you think. In addition to making you feel things, it should make you think. And thinking is not something you do easily if I don't give you different ideas, different polar viewpoints and nuance. If it's just like, this is bad, it's asking you to accept an answer and not think about the question. Mm-hmm. And I don't want to give answers. I want to give questions. And so I tried for, I mean, there's some people I know who think the book is preachy. I've seen some reviews that suggest that they feel that it's too political and that it's making too many statements, but I tried diligently to offer alternative sort of viewpoints and different types of characters who feel and believe different things. And even in the quote unquote protagonist, the what you would conceive as the good characters, they have massive falls from grace and they have, you know, complexities inside their hearts and they do bad things. And sometimes some of the not good characters to occasionally good things or say something that you think, oh, that makes sense. And you're like, oh, that's upsetting me now that someone horrible said something that makes sense. So I think trying to put all of those things in there and giving those layers hopefully gives people a richer experience and doesn't just kind of lead them to the meal and demand them to eat it, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. As I think about that, there really is such a complex movement in each of those main characters that there's none of them that you're just like, yeah, you did it. Good job.
Right. Yeah, exactly. I don't want to write like a heroic arc in the strictest sense. I'm not trying to tell like a superhero story where it's like, oh, there was, you know, oh, it's hard and they faced adversity and now they're good. It's just, you know, I mean, this is like an epic story. I wanted to feel that sense of complexity and nuance and, you know, fiddly bits. Yeah.
Well, without spoiling the end, by the end, you're just like, I don't know. I don't know if I've ever had a book that felt that way at the end where you're just like, well, I don't know. Okay.
Yeah. All right. That's good. I'll take that. I like that feeling.
I was going to ask you about, Pastor Matthew in the book. I feel like, and now hearing you talk about, the Satanist stuff, were you raised in a Christian home?
No, oh, I was really? Not actually. Okay. No, my mother was Catholic, and because she, prior to my father, divorced her husband prior to my dad, the Catholic Church, you know, of course, would not accept her. So I know she tried to do things like I think baptized me on her own in a tub, and you're like, I don't think that works, not Catholically speaking. And I know she tried to send me to Sunday school, and then I remember one day I came home like just crying. I'm like, well, there's a guy bleeding on a couple of sticks up there, and I find this very disturbing. So I didn't go back to Sunday school, but I've always sort of wrestled with it. My dad was very non-religious. He believed in quite literally what he called the God of the land, which I don't even know what that means. And he was never super clear on it, but he was very much about gardening and farming, and he believed that there was some God in the land he was appeasing. And I was like, you know, are you murdering people in the corn? Like, that feels like that's what's happening here. I just feel like you can admit it. You can tell me. But no such admission ever came. I was not raised religious, okay. But I had friends who were, and I know I watched my mother grapple with her sort of waning and waxing Catholicism.
Okay.
And I studied it in college, religion. I found it interesting.
I just found that coming from my background, I found that character very believable. And that's impressive that you didn't kind of grow up in that. But I mean, as much as, you know, I'm at this point disagreeing with, you know, most of what he is believing in certain senses, like you see that he's trying to do good and he's grappling with these issues, and he's got a framework though that's like leading him to certain answers. And I don't know, I felt like the way you handled that character specifically was really great.
Thank you.
Yeah. I don't know. He's kind of the lens through which one of the arcs of that book moves, and it's a, you know, kind of a brutal progression, but
yeah, it's a brutal journey for him. He was hard to write in that regard. I think necessary, but I mean, obviously you never know in terms of what's necessary or not necessary in fiction, but he felt necessary to me, and it felt necessary to give him as much of that sort of wriggly, you know, uncomfortable morality and questions. I mean, he's a guy trying to, like you say, he's trying to do right, but there's people who want to take advantage of his wanting to do right. And just because, you know, and it's not even just the people in the book, but obviously some of his upbringing and some of what he's been taught about things are complicated, and how he reacts to things, even things with his wife or things with his son. Yeah. He's a weird character to write.
Damn. That's tough. It's hard.
Yeah.
I wanted to talk to you a little bit about, horror as like a genre, because I feel like some people, if they've never read any or gotten into any, it seems like well, that's just icky, that's just bad.
Yeah,
but like, why you tend to gravitate towards writing stuff that's at least horror adjacent?
Yes.
Why is it good? Like, what is?
I think horror, obviously, there's the sort of illicit thrill of it, just the roller coaster ride aspect of horror. Like, you're experiencing a kind of fear, but in a controlled environment.
Yeah.
You know that what you're reading is not real, just as you know a roller coaster is not real, but you still, your body and mind are capable of producing a fear reaction, but it's a fear reaction that's cathartic. So
yeah,
that's obviously what you're getting out of that at the surface. But then fiction itself, horror fiction, it's also uncomfortable. And sometimes what you're reading is like, no, the surface level horror isn't real, but there's something deeper under the water that's absolutely true about it. Kind of getting back to that stuff you're talking about being, you know, truth versus fact, or what's good and what's true. There is some stuff in horror that can be genuinely true. It's genuinely telling you something, or at least opining on something. It's giving you a thought, a perspective. And that's another thing I like about horror, is that it contextualizes some very big, weird stuff. And it's not even a genre in the sense that it's about your plot beats. You know, certain genres are about plot beats. A detective is like, we're going to do this and then build the clues this way, and we're going to reveal the murder by the end. Horror can be in anything. It's an emotion. It's one of the few, you know, it's like thriller in a sense. Like, it's a genre that's about an evocation of emotion. Comedy, it's like, it's just there to make you laugh. That doesn't mean you can't have comedy in space. Doesn't mean you can't have horror that's historical fiction. Horror doesn't even need to be the genre. It can just be a thing that it's in the book. Most books and stories in some capacity have at least scenes of what you would consider to be quote unquote horror. And that's great to me, because it's such a vital tool in the author's tool belt, that for people to dismiss it too easily is like, you're not acknowledging something that's useful to really every storyteller.
Yeah, that's cool. I wanted to ask you about, in the good category, representation. So you got some praise and mostly a lot of shit for having, I think it was the first LGBT protagonist in the new Star Wars canon? Or is that wrong?
Yeah, I think in the new canon. I think there was prior to that also in the new canon, an LGBT antagonist, I think. But yes, yeah, I think that's right. Protagonist, yeah.
Yeah, so I just was curious about, I don't know, like your maybe progression in thought in thinking about representation in your books, or why you feel like that's important.
I mean, I can tell you in retrospect, it's important because at any event that I've done, especially like the bigger Comic-Con type events, I have a lot of LGBT readers of those books, Star Wars fans and readers who come up and are like really, I mean, they're moved. And I don't mean to, I really run the risk here of making it sound like, well, gosh, I'm a hero. I did a really good thing. And it's really not the point. I just mean, if people are seeing themselves in a place where they've never seen themselves mm-hmm. before, especially Star Wars, which is this massive, massive, probably arguably the biggest story world. I mean, Marvel is obviously Titanic too, but Star Wars is, you know, now 40 plus years of existence. And so to have been kept out of that and not see yourself there, is really a pretty good way to tell you that it's not your story, that it's like, well, it's this, you know, this is for these people and you can enjoy it, but it's not really mm-hmm. for you. And that sucks because obviously Star Wars should be the biggest possible tent. So for me, it's just about, you know, Star Wars is just about making the biggest tent possible. So many people saw that as like a political statement, but I'm like, I don't think including different types of characters should be conceived of as a political statement, outside of the fact that at the most basic level, everything is political, especially stories. But I mean, it's not, yeah. it's not Democrat, Republican, it's not progressive versus conservative. It's just like, well, there are a lot of different people in the world and we should try to, you know, speak to them and make sure that they are all finding a seat at the table in this massive, massive story world.
Yeah. I think the position that you should not include it, that's like that's a partisan position. That's saying like, no, keep them out.
Right.
But it's like, no, but if you just look around, like these are people in the world and
right.
we should see
right.
some
reflection
of that.
And they should also be given
yeah.
a seat at the table to write the stories. Mm-hmm. It shouldn't just be about me giving them character room. I mean, it should be actually be fundamental to both in terms of the authorial level or production level, directorial level. I mean, that's, you know, this type of thing is a variegated quilt. You need to get it up and down the pike.
Yep.
But for my purposes, I can't change that.
Yeah,
I was
yeah.
the one writing the book. So what I can do is ensure that the characters are representative.
And then you also get a fair amount of shit for being vocal about certain things on Twitter and other places, which I've always like, I don't know. I think there's such a, like so many of your tweets, like there's such a compassion for humanity and for people. And then sometimes you're really mad. And I feel like I like the combination of seeing your heart in the sense of like, hey, I'm showing compassion in this way. And then I'm showing compassion through anger. I think in other times you do it with some style. I feel like, do you ever watch Deadwood?
Oh yeah,
so
of course.
Like,
yeah,
I feel
there's
like
some,
you have a
very creative
Swearengen aspect.
Yeah.
Not as Elizabethan, maybe, but there's a creativity.
No, I'll take that.
But yeah, you got fired from doing those Star Wars Vader things for speaking out. What?
Yeah, against Kavanaugh.
Yeah,
Kavanaugh.
So like, and it's something that I struggle with as well, because I'm making music, but then I care about reality, right? And so I feel like I should speak out against certain things or for certain things. And I don't know, how do you look at trying to balance that out as a creator?
It's tough, and it's a this is like a complicated thing, because some of it gets into the nature of what Twitter is and does, and some of it's about stories and storytellers, and if we have a responsibility, and I don't think that we do. I don't think there is a responsibility, as in it's our job to have or share those opinions. But I think we're also uniquely placed, not just storytellers, but musicians and artists are uniquely placed here to be able to contextualize all kinds of things in a way that's, again, artistic or metaphorical, or whether it's just creative profanity. And I while I don't think it's their job to have an opinion or to state those opinions, I also don't think they should be kept from having those opinions. First of all, because artists are people, as it turns out, as much as some people want them to be, you know, like wage slaves or people who just don't contribute anything at all. If we are to assume that everybody has a voice, then certainly artists and writers and musicians have an equal voice. And so there's no reason we shouldn't talk about this, just as people, just as having the ability to engage on subjects. And then, you know, in a sense, to try to, you know, talk about what we're feeling about a thing and to move people to, you know, consider that opinion or to be argued with. So you are, you know, are having that living conversation. But, you know, Twitter is also sometimes one of those places where it's great and bad to have those kinds of conversations. It gets difficult.
Yeah.
Because there's increasingly so little signal and so much noise. So it's hard. I was talking because Twitter being what it is, like I was talking with friends recently, and it's like Twitter kind of used to be a little bit more of a water cooler place for writers, you know, in terms of our perspective as writers.
Mm-hmm.
We would go there to talk about whatever was going on in the industry or ourselves. And it was, I mean, we knew it was public, but it was still kind of like quiet chatter, and links were not big news stories. They were just like a link, or you didn't have a bunch of photos. It was just mostly just text posts. And, that has changed. It changed from water cooler to a stage, and everybody's up on that stage. And so it gets difficult to know who's saying things because they believe them or who's saying things because they're trying to chase clout or whatever it is. And then, you know, when you say a thing, you don't want to be, you know, you want to try to be authentic with it and not seem like you're just trying to score points.
Yeah.
And then you're like, you know, did I say that right? Did I make sure I convinced people? And then you double down, or it starts to like get to a point where you're like, I don't know that I might be giving too much to this thing, and not getting enough reality back. And I don't know where that stands now.
Yeah. And I think you also have something I struggle with. Like the main thing that keeps me from posting certain things at certain times is like kind of the law of diminishing returns. Like I want people to hear this important thing, but if it's all I talk about, then I feel like I'm like losing the ear, and that's really hard to balance. And I feel like, I don't know, right now with what's everything going on, I'm really not giving shit about that, but but I don't know. Yeah. It's weird. And there is that weird, strange standard of like, hey, I listen to you basically saying things through your art all the time, but you don't actually have you don't have a human voice here. You only get your artist voice.
Right.
And I don't think that's fair. And I think they're two different things. Like I do think your point often can be made deeper in your art, but it's subtler too. And there's times that require,
because if it's not subtle, it's preaching.
Yes.
Right. It goes back to that thing we were talking about. It's that you're just yelling at people.
Yeah. But there's that time to like, stand up and yell like this thing is wrong. Like, and no one has time for you to read 5 books about it right now. Like, you know, like,
no, exactly.
I don't know. Hey everyone, if you're already supporting the show through Patreon, thank you so very much. If you aren't yet, I wanted to let you know that you can now become a patron and support the show for as little as $5 a month. Becoming a patron can provide you with a variety of perks, including access to additional content like song lyric breakdown episodes, Q&A episodes where you can submit questions for me to answer, additional conversation episodes that won't show up in the public feed, and access to our Discord board where we're building community and engaging in deeper conversations around the show. Here's a sneak peek at some additional patron-only content. That's an interesting question, the self-talk or inner dialogue. I think for one, it was like, there was like 2 days where it was kind of debilitating, the weird kind of introspection that went on as I came to
grips with being pretty sure about this. And I was thinking, like, I don't know how to describe it. You know, like if you, sometimes you might be like introspective about what you're doing. I was like a level deeper into introspection. So I was like two steps removed from reality, thinking about everything that I was doing or feeling. And I was really worried that was going to continue, but that did not. That was more just a kind of a reorienting. And then I realized, hey, you're okay. You've always been this way and you're fine. So you don't need to overanalyze it, but it does give you different tools when you have some kind of understanding sometimes of an issue and some maybe more grace for yourselves and for yourself and an opportunity to challenge yourself in different ways. So for me, I think sometimes it means giving myself permission to like take a break from a social situation that might be kind of hypercharged for me and overwhelming. Other times it's being in that situation and acknowledging how I'm feeling and taking some deep breaths. And that understanding of what's kind of going on with me and that it's okay that I feel that way, can be, I think, a lot more healthy than just feeling overwhelmed, but not really being able to take a little step outside of that and, acknowledge it. You know, so I think it's almost been part of a larger change in self-talk and inner dialogue where I just have more understanding of myself and for myself.
If you're digging this podcast and want to join me and others like you in our pursuit of the good, the true, and the beautiful, then joining us on Patreon is the best way to do it. Sign up today at patreon.com/carrythefirepod. All right, let's get back to the show. All right, on to the beautiful. What does beauty mean to you in your everyday life?
Beauty in my everyday life is like little things, just moments. And nature is a huge aspect to me for beauty. Like I'm a big proponent of authors, and actually really sort of any artist, finding a creative outlet for them that is separate from the thing you do for money. And that is something you don't do for money. For me, it's photography. I am not a professional photographer. I have been paid on a few instances on a lark, not because I have tried to.
Yeah.
So I don't consider myself a professional by any, I don't even really know what I'm doing. Like, I mean, I have some sense of it. But I try not to know what I'm doing. I just want to just go out and take pictures of bugs and birds and see what happens. And, that to me is where I find those weird little moments of beauty, just sort of weird, sublime moments of coincidence or things you didn't know you were going to see when you were outside.
Yeah. Photography is an interesting art form in that sense, because it's more than anything else, it's about like looking for that little moment of beauty, right? Like,
yes,
everything else you're like processing it and you're taking it and you're trying to re put it out there. But photography, you're like, there's something right there and I see it.
Yeah. And I want to see it. Yeah.
To capture it in some sense.
Yeah. I want other people to see it, or cool. I want to be able to look at it again. Yeah.
You live kind of out in the sticks. Yeah. Like,
it's not as sticky as it used to be. My last place was really sticky, okay. but it's still pretty much the sticks. Like, it's tons of like, just not a whole lot here. A
lot of animals running around.
We got foxes and deer.
Yeah, I remember the foxes. And you ended up having foxes in the new place too, right?
Yeah, we don't have them as a den, okay. But we've seen them multiple times, so it's good. They crap on our yard, so they're here.
I brought this up a little earlier, but you have a little shed, whatever.
I do. I got a shed, yeah. I had one at the last place, and this one I had built, and they got it done like the day or two before lockdown started.
Oh, that's good. So
it's like perfectly timed that I could get this thing.
Yeah, I moved to a new place like right before lockdown and had a little more space, which was huge. So
fortuitous, yes. Yeah.
So when you're at, like, is it exclusively like this is where you write? Do you do other stuff out there? Like,
Currently, it's just where I write. I mean, I have bookshelves that are we just got and don't have any books on them yet. I have the books in storage. So it'll be a place I read. And I think I'll probably get I had a treadmill that I was thinking of putting out here, but honestly, I don't really enjoy the treadmill. It's kind of dull. So thinking of getting something else out here in terms of exercise.
Cool. Do you find having that kind of dedicated space pretty necessary for writing?
Yeah, if only because, like at our last place, I had a corner office on the second floor, and it was really nice. It looked over, like overlooked the woods. It was pretty beautiful. But we had a kid, and by the time you know your kid gets to be like 4 or 5 years old, they're gonna like you can't just be like, no, I'm working, so don't bother me. They just don't get that, and I don't blame them. I'm not mad at him for not getting it, but like he'll John McClane his way into the vents. You can't stop that kid from coming into my office when I'm working. So it's like, all right, I need something, especially because it was at that time I was ramping up the Star Wars work, and I had a month to write the first draft. The first book, yeah,
really?
1 month.
Uh-huh. Wow.
Yeah, a little tight deadlines. So, yeah, so just to have that extra space somewhere. When you try to figure out what it was, like, do you get a garage space or do I get an external office that I go to every day? And we thought, well, we have the woods. Let's put a box in the woods where I go to write.
Okay. So I'm going to come back to that question. We've hit on all of them. Is there a writer or books that have struck you as particularly capturing and commuting beauty to you?
That Exquisite Corpse book, mm-hmm. As grotesque as it was, there was something beautiful about that. You know, beauty's tricky in terms of fiction because for me, beauty usually comes down to prose and how the words come together.
So who stands out?
Toni Morrison's. Okay. The work of Toni Morrison is, I mean, astonishing. Song of Solomon. Just really amazing. Beloved. You're talking about a horror novel that's not a horror novel. Beloved. My God. And I got to meet Toni Morrison, which was a very cool moment.
Oh, cool.
Yeah, there's definitely, I mean, James Joyce's Ulysses, right? I mean, that's a weird, speaking of books that sort of combine all that aspect of truth and beauty and everything else at the same time. Joyce's Ulysses covers truth and beauty and kind of everything in one big tango because it's this massive brick of a book that takes like a daily life, just a day in the life, and gives it mythic scope. And that's interesting because we're all kind of the heroes in our own world and we're all sort of, you know, both grappling with the sort of moral complexities of a daily existence and also the sort of black and white mythic cut of existence. And so I thought there was something really fascinating in some of his prose, especially in before Joyce gets really indulgent, you know, like The Dead, the novella, or Portrait of an Artist. There's some really profoundly beautiful sentences just that he's written.
It makes me, when I was trying to think about it myself, I was thinking of, the thing that came to mind was, McCarthy.
Yeah. Cormac McCarthy.
Just some, especially like, I remember in The Road, it's like so sparse and dry feeling. And then he would just like insert these little, almost mini poem prose type things. And it was such a weird contrast. I loved it.
I agree with
that. That's cool. All right. I think this is the last question. Do you have any consistent practices or habits that are helpful for you?
I did. I don't know that I do now. My everything has been with after writing Wanderers and then obviously the quarantines are very different. You know, generally speaking for me, it was all about just sitting down and finding a secure time and a secure place to write. And then knowing how to not be distracted, you know, writing for 45 minutes, kind of screw off for 15, whatever it was. That's changed a little for me, though the core precept remains the same, that when it's time for rubber meets road, you've got to sort of, again, protect your time and protect your space in whatever way you have to. And for me, like talking about the shed, that's something that's for me about protecting space and making sure that I have a place to go and take it seriously, because so few people take art seriously, whether themselves, but largely sort of as a society. People just don't respect it. Like, They're like, what are you doing writing a book? Like, well, can you do something different? Like, just do something different right now. You can go back to writing your stupid book later, but can you do these 10 things for me? And it's like, no, but this is important and you have to like really, and because you hear other people treat it that way, you can, you internalize that. You're so like, well, maybe it isn't that important. I'm just writing stupid stories. Who cares? And then that's how you lose it. And that's how it goes away. So you got to protect it.
Yeah. I think it's also, yes, you have that. And you also have like the idea that, you don't have a boss, like you don't have, you know what I'm saying? Like it's, I sometimes long for like a boss so that I can be like, hey, they said I have to go work, you know, like,
right.
Because, you know, there's, I mean, especially you got a family and there's like, well, yeah, I really need to do this. But like, technically I don't have to do it right this minute, but that easily happens all the time.
Right,
all the time.
Right, right. Exactly. No, that's exactly it. Yeah. And you don't, so I try to let like my mortgage statements be my boss. I like, you know, like pin them up, be like, they're, it's funny, I'm being yelled at by my bills right now. So,
yeah. Yeah. I feel like the quarantine has definitely made all of that much harder.
Oh, so much harder.
My wife's working at home and, I built us like a desk into this like little closet in our room, but it's really, we can't, she's on meetings all day on Zoom and I'm trying to write. It's just like, this is insane. And the kids are doing school and, yeah. So it's
yeah.
very,
yeah. Everybody just lives hard. In this bubble and they're all on screens. Yeah. It's tough.
All right, man. Well, it was a pleasure talking to you. I really appreciate you taking the time.
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you.
Yeah. Everybody go read Wanders and other Chuck things. What, where should they keep up with what's going on with you?
I'm on a Twitter hiatus, so that's probably not, at least currently you're not going to find me there, but I'm at Chuck Wendig there. I'm at Chuck_Wendig on Instagram. And, the blog is usually the cleanest, simplest place to find me. And that's terribleminds.com.
Cool. Awesome. Well, thanks so much, man. I appreciate it.
Hey, thanks, man.
If you have a moment today, it would help a ton if you could leave us a review on Apple Podcasts and share this episode with a friend. Be sure to follow the podcast on Twitter and Instagram at @CarryTheFirePod.
I want to thank my producer, Andy Lara, and all of our executive producers,
Chris Reeves, Tony Panaro, Sam George, Brandon Valencia, Reed Duchess, Thomas Fortcourt, Shamir Hassan, Amy Armstrong, Luis Rivera, Gabe Munoz, Cameron Lane, Michael Maitland, Andrew Diaz, Adam Collins, Susanna Coleman, Ian Hunt, John Paul Diego, David Cobb, Jess Card, Mark Weiss, Brianna Webb, John Buchan, Denise Sagita, Colin Hawthorne, Brian Weisbecker, Joshua Millara, Eric Gonzalez, Matthew Alcon, Tiffany Payne, and Sean Weidmeyer.
Thank you all so much for carrying the fire with me, and I'll see you next time.